At the end of that first Letterman decade, John Fine was trying to make it in a band. It was the late 80s. He'd met a couple of other guys in college. They'd recorded a record. They called themselves Bitch Magnet. They made a go of it for a couple of years, but then they graduated, split up, got real jobs, moved on. Standard stuff. Except that 20 years later, this weird little college band played a sold-out reunion tour worldwide. John Fine is now a business journalist, executive editor of the magazine Inc., and he's written a lovely new memoir called Your Band Sucks, What I Saw at Indie Rock's Failed Revolution. John Fine, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here, Kurt.
So for the very, very few of our listeners who have never heard of Bitch Magnet, how would you describe the music you made?
We were an aggressive post-punk band that formed in 1986 and ran through 1990. If I really want to subdivide it, and I do, I would say like post-hardcore, but we're getting into the kind of gradations that are meaningless to the greater outside world.
Let's, in fact, listen to a clip of Bitch Magnet. This is called Dragoon. It's from your final album called Ben-Hur. So that was Bitch Magnet playing Dragoon from
1990.
Now, Bitch Magnet was more than just some college band. According to the Cognoscenti, you actually had a real small but real influence on 90s rock. The Onion, I see, says you, quote, laid the foundation for post-rock. Do those kinds of things, the fact that, you know, you're at least a large footnote to the history of rock, does that make you feel good?
I think that to be a large footnote, you're something along the size of Sonic Youth. I mean, this is a footnote to the footnote of the footnote. I mean, it's like the 18th citation, if it's that.
Yeah.
But you know, having said that—
But better than nothing.
It is absolutely better than nothing. And, you know, one of the things about this book is that our records were reissued in 2011. We were asked to reunite 21 years after we broke up, and we were kind of like, okay, we'll do this. And so we toured through America and Europe and Asia. And honestly, too, it was astonishing that people remembered and said kind things. I mean, that's—
And that people in Tokyo and Singapore by the thousands showed up.
I would not say by the thousands.
Hundreds.
We would play in Hong Kong, and there was someone from Taiwan who didn't speak English, who flew over with like an original pressing of our first record, which we printed ourselves in an edition of 1,000. I mean, how he got that, I have no idea.
But that must have been fun, even though the fact of in your 40s going on a reunion tour around the world sounds like a, you know, an Adam Sandler high concept movie or something. But it must have been such a pleasure because you presumably weren't thinking, and suddenly this time we're going to be famous.
No, it was amazing. You know, it was a kind of reminder of the things that I really liked about this community, which I'd eventually soured on at a certain point. To see there was still that kind of connection, to share all the same references, the feeling that we all, you know, we all want to be understood. And I have very complicated feelings about this whole indie rock culture, but I felt like we all knew the same stuff. We all understood each other. And that was really moving and amazing. And that happened.
And your sales were like in the same ballpark as sales of literary novels in the tens of thousands as opposed to the millions. So have you ever thought about an alternate history? What if you had become rich and famous in this band, not maybe Nirvana level, but Fugazi level or something? Would that have been great?
That would have been amazing. That it didn't happen was kind of all right, too. But, you know, there was a time when the world was sending me signals that if I wanted to, oh, I don't know, like afford housing and food, that I should probably find something else to do with most of my time. But there are a lot of people I know who stuck with it. And I want to be clear about this. They're the courageous ones. I mean, like, I bagged out when it got too uncomfortable for too long.
But you kept in it, and I've known you for a while, but you kept in it longer than I knew. Really, through your 20s, you were still doing this.
Well into my 30s.
Yeah, into your early 30s.
I was in a band in Brooklyn called Coptic Light, and we went through Japan twice. And the second time, I was 38 years old. So, yeah, I mean, this was an enormous part of my life for I don't know, 20, 22 years.
Yeah.
I was happy to let it ruin my life for that long.
And what's lovely about this book is you are clearly not bitter. Although I never got famous, or we were better than this band that did. It was a lovely decade in your life.
It was a lovely time. But if you and I were having this conversation in 1998 or 1999, I'd have a much different spin on it. Because at that point, I was very actively upset that, you know, my fantasies of what this indie world would be were not coming true.
You mean, apart from your success or lack of it, the revolution wasn't happening.
The revolution wasn't happening. The giant major labels were as powerful as ever, more powerful than ever. They were, I'm doing air quotes, co-opting some of the bands in this world that had more overt commercial potential. Those bands, Pixies, Smashing Pumpkins, Hole, those got identified with the stuff, which really drove me insane. And to be honest, it still kind of does.
You talk in the book about the band's name, Bitch Magnet, how you meant it as ironically macho, and how people have suggested to you that if not for the name, you might have had more commercial success. Do you think that?
I didn't think that. I don't really think that, but more than one person said that when they were reviewing our reissues. And, you know, it's an interesting thought. I mean, like, we would have situations where, you know, the booking agent would call me up and say, like, hey, on this next tour, I got you guys a gig at Wellesley College. And I'd be like, that's never going to happen. He's like, oh, come on, it will. Don't be a wuss. I'm like, all right, I'm telling you. And then the next day he would call me back and say, Wellesley canceled. I was like, well, yeah. The name of the band is Bitch Magnet, you moron, you know. We were 18 years old when we chose the name.
Yeah.
I think we thought it was funny. There was obviously a play on machismo. I'm not sure how well that scanned.
Yeah.
It's weird. You know, as a 47-year-old man, that's probably not a name I would choose. But, like, I'm not going to walk away from it. I mean, like, we did this thing and, like, it
– it's a tattoo you got. You're not going to erase it. You're going to keep it on there.
If it was a tattoo, if it was a tattoo, I'd keep it. But with all the repetition, it loses it. But then I'll have a conversation with, like, a civilian and I'll see their eyes kind of go gazunga. I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got to have this conversation. All right, whatever.
You write about a thing that middle-aged people are know about, which is the charm of finding this one weird album in the one record store in town. Another thing about growing up later than you did is the fact that the entire history of rock and roll is available at a click. That must be a profoundly different thing, don't you think?
It's an enormously different thing. And speaking as someone who just spent a good 2 hours on Saturday, like, digging through incredibly obscure British 70s hard rock albums by bands no one's heard of, like Incredible Hog, great record. That's a huge thing. I cannot separate this experience from having to work for all of it. Our drummer wasn't as obsessed as the bass player and songwriter Soo Young and I were. Soo Young and I, we were, like, you know, reading fanzines, you know, like, trying to connect all these dots. I've heard about this record by this band. Where can I find it? That was the thing.
I looked it up on Wikipedia, and now I'm doing what they're doing.
And rather than I looked it up on Wikipedia and I've absorbed the entire thing and I've gone on to the next thing. I mean, like, maybe having to work for it was more important. Maybe it was important that there were fewer reference points. You know, like, you could easily sort of see what it was. I would never want to argue that more information and better access to information is a bad thing.
And you, in general, you sound optimistic about what the internet has done to the music business, to music. Although if you kept at it past 30 and you were trying to make a living or making a living, maybe you wouldn't be so optimistic. That's the sort of working yeoman musician. It's really made life tough, hasn't it?
It's made life very tough for certain musicians, and it's made life very tough for a certain class of musician that is, for instance, living off record sales. Basically, as a musician now, you have to look at it as an entirely different hustle. It is easier for an artist to find a niche audience. It is easier for an artist to have a direct relationship with that audience. And there are artists who are good at that. Not all artists are.
Yeah. Speaking of the internet, I saw that you, Bitch Magnet, is on Spotify. And I was interested that song we played earlier, Dragoon, is the most popular on Spotify by a factor of two to whatever was a number two. What does that tell you? Why?
I'm flabbergasted. I'm also thrilled because
I'm giving you metrics.
You're giving me metrics, and I love the data. Dragoon is a 10-minute long song. There are no vocals for approximately 3.5 minutes. It tells me that the people listening to Bitch Magnet on Spotify are serious about it. They're not looking for the pop song in as much as there was one. You know, that is a almost preposterously ambitious song. It is 10 minutes long, multiple time signature changes, like all these different passages. The vocals are completely buried and pretty much spoken the entire time when they are there at all.
So the good news is the people who are listening really appreciate you. The bad news is there's only 13,000 listens so far.
I'm happy for every one of them.
What do you think about what we call indie rock today? Sometimes it seems to me like one of those phrases like postmodern that just is so widely slung around it has no meaning. Does it have meaning?
Juan McLean, who's a renowned DJ and who was in the fabulous band Six Finger Satellite, I'm going to mangle the quote slightly, but he said a great thing, which was something like, indie rock became this thing that was what I was rebelling against in the first place, and it made me so angry. And you know that was kind of happening in the latter 90s when like a much stronger pop sensibility sort of came in, but kind of a sort of naive pop sensibility. And like eventually like a middle of the road appears and everyone goes towards it. However, when you're 25 years old and you've built your entire worldview around this thing and it's going away from you, it's incredibly upsetting.
You are now the executive editor of Inc., the magazine, business magazine aimed at entrepreneurs. What would your 21-year-old punk rock self think of this gig?
The 21-year-old would probably be amazed that I have an actual job and also be kind of horrified by it, but that's fine. I was the last full-time band I was in before Bitch Magnet reunited was a really strange band that I'm sure the 18-year-old me definitely would have despised, and I was really into that idea. I really liked that I had found a new way to do
that's
something
interesting.
That was interesting.
That's rebellious, right? To know that the young you would have hated the current you.
Sometimes that's the only rebellion you get in middle age, Kurt. What can I tell you?
John Fine, it has been a pleasure, as always. Nice talking to you.
Right back at you.
John Fine's memoir, Your Band Sucks, is just out.